Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the pleasure of speaking with the distinguished Todd Osmundson, PhD, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Todd is a faculty member in the Department of Biology, and his research specialties include studying the ecology, genetic relationships, geographic distributions, and conservation biology of bacteria and especially fungi, using fieldwork, microscopy, and molecular genetic or DNA-based tools. The winding path of his professional mycology career really began during a fateful encounter with a local mushroom club in Montana. Since then, Todd has conducted mycological fieldwork in the U.S., French Polynesia, China, Mexico, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Svalbard, Thailand, and Australia. His varied research projects have seen him span alpine, arctic, tropical, and temperate habitats in search of fungi. There are few people more familiar with the process of finding, observing, extracting genetic material, and DNA sequencing fungi. I'm excited to learn more about where we are in that process of cataloging fungal populations, what that means for mycology, and how citizen scientists can be a part of this process. Todd, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I should have said the distinguished Todd Osmundson. Thank you for being on the show.
I'm totally quoting that in my next promotion packet.
Definitely. Well, like I said, I think it's well warranted. And there's a ton to talk about. You know, you sent over a lot of information. I've read a number of your papers. So you've got a career full of interesting work when it comes to fungi. But before we jump into it all, I am interested to hear the story that I alluded to about how you discovered mycology and found yourself in a career based around mushrooms.
Sure. Well, I'd like to say that I was interested in mushrooms from my earliest days as a child, but that's not true at all. I hated them.
Yeah.
I grew up as a Midwestern kid eating canned mushrooms and Campbell's cream and mushroom soup, so I didn't really develop a taste for the kingdom. And I moved to Montana after graduating from college, where I took a bunch of odd jobs working at the dump and trailer parks and a commercial laundry and all sorts of things to support what had become a rabid habit of backcountry skiing. And I was driving down the road one day, heard a community calendar announcement on the local public radio station about a local mushroom club meeting, decided I would show up, and they were planning their annual truffle dinner, where they, which they used as a fundraiser. And this was a club run by Larry Evans, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners know. Immediately pressed me into service as a waiter for that truffle dinner. And with my new friends, I started hanging out in the woods, and I was hooked. Just being out in the forest and wondering, what is this, and what is this, and what is that, was just such a fantastic experience for me that I knew I had to go further into it.
And I love that story of someone who, you know, you don't come from a particularly scientific background, or, you know, you're someone who just got interested in fungi and were able to pursue a career in it, which is just super inspiring. I know there are folks listening, myself included, who hear that story, and it makes you think, wow, I really can pursue a career in mycology if I choose, which is really inspiring story to find ourselves in. After your experience in Montana, what was a little bit of that path academically where you actually did, you know, find yourself now at University of Wisconsin? How did you get there, and what were a couple of those steps along the way?
Well, as part of this mushroom club in Western Montana, we invited Dr. Kathy Cripps to come and give a talk. She had recently arrived in a faculty position at Montana State, about 200 miles away from Missoula, where I was living. She came, and we had reserved this community room at a shopping mall. So it seems a little surreal in retrospect, Kathy, up there. My professional mycological career starting in a shopping mall as shoppers were walking by the windows, kind of peering into the room, wondering what in the world was going on. But after Kathy's talk, I went up and talked to her and said, I'm really interested in mycology. What might I do to go further into it? And thankfully, she took that as a commitment, as a life-defining moment, and took me under her wing. And I took her summer class. She did a summer field class at Montana State. She was also familiar with an opportunity that researchers at the Field Museum in Chicago had, or they had a 3-year program where they each summer had an intern working on a biodiversity project looking at the diversity of Eastern North American fungi versus Chinese fungi. And every summer they, for the 3 years of this project, they took an undergraduate student with them to China and around the Eastern U.S. to survey fungi. So I applied for that job at Kathy's recommendation and got it. And I was further hooked. And then Kathy got a grant studying alpine fungi on the Beartooth Plateau, which is just north of Yellowstone National Park, and took me on as a master's student.
Wow, so we have Kathy Cripps to thank for Todd Osmundson's illustrious mycology career.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, between Larry Evans, Kathy Cripps, you had some people that, you know, you can't help but get excited about fungi when you have those kind of influences early on.
Right, exactly. Then I was lucky to go on and work with Roy Halling as a PhD student in New York at the New York Botanical Garden.
Wow.
Really inspiring people.
Yeah, it always helps to work with really inspiring people. And I mean, it sounds like your path was really pushed by those, you know, just following opportunity, which is something that we all want to believe that we would do when presented with it, but it can be tougher than you think to make that leap of faith and just say, you know, I believe in my connection with this person or what they can offer and just jump into an opportunity like that. And I see here that you actually got to study classical guitar along this journey as well.
Right. I took up classical guitar in college for a little while, had a small guitar studio teaching classical guitar to kids in Montana. And when I got to New York, I was studying at Columbia University, and they happened to have this sort of backdoor program where you could audition and take lessons free of charge on campus. And it turns out that many of the instructors are Juilliard instructors. So I actually got to take guitar lessons from a Juilliard instructor through this back door. I never would have been able to get into Juilliard, but
from humble waiter at a truffle dinner to mycology PhD work and studying at Juilliard. Yeah, I'd say, you know, following opportunity definitely put you in some great situations there. And then I know after that, you actually came out my way to California to continue your research.
Right. At about the time that I was graduating from a PhD program, I got a call from Sarah Bergman, who's a professor at Middle Tennessee State University, who had recently left her postdoctoral position at UC Berkeley. And she and Matteo Garbellato at UC Berkeley were looking for a postdoctoral researcher to take part in this project in French Polynesia on a little island called Morea. I jumped at the chance and ended up spending 5 years in California, about 5 months of which was spent on this little island in French Polynesia.
That's wild. That island of Morea, I've never even heard of it, but you were finding, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different mushrooms. What was that fungal landscape like there? And was that your first exposure to really unique fungal populations outside the U.S.?
It wasn't. I got to study as part of my PhD program with Dr. Halling in Australia and Thailand. And
oh, wow.
I got to do a lot of traveling as a doctoral student. But Morea, this was part of a project called the Morea Biocode Project, which was dreamed up when the director of the Gump Field Station, it's a UC Berkeley field station on this island, was on Craig Venter's yacht, Craig Venter of the Human Genome fame.
Right, right.
And they cooked up this idea to study Morea as a model ecosystem, kind of how we have model species in genetics, to use this island, characterize every organism on that island, every macroscopic organism on the island, using and getting a DNA barcode sequence for it, and then using that database of knowledge to try to understand the interactions between organisms. So we were the fungal team. So the three of us were tasked with describing and sequencing all of the fungi on this island, which is a pretty Herculean task. I don't think we got there, but so we gave it a good try.
Now, was that plot-based collections, or how did you guys get those field samples to try to get, you know, an exhaustive sense of the population?
We collected everything we could get our hands on. We set up plots, we climbed mountains, we collected leaves, soil, wood, root samples, mushrooms, everything we could get our hands on. And then we sequenced it as well as we possibly could.
Yeah, and I want to get more into that process of sequencing, because I've talked with folks in the citizen science realm who have done that kind of work, but I've never really gone in depth into what that entails and then how you use that data to actually discover something about the fungi, even if it's not as clear-cut species-wise as you would think. But what are some of the insights you get from doing that? You know, when you take an island like Morea, you discover, if not exhaustive, a nigh-exhaustive list of the fungal populations, where they are, what they are. What kind of insights can you then pull out of that mass of identification data?
It really depends a lot on the system that you're working in and how much is known to begin with. One of the things that I was really interested in on this island is, where do those fungi come from? This is a volcanic island. It was a volcanic hotspot island. So it basically came out of the middle of the ocean.
How did fungi get there? Yeah.
Right. How do they get there? And where were they coming from? And there have been studies of other organisms, particularly birds, that are really well studied throughout these Polynesian islands. So you could build phylogenies and really understand the relationships of individuals or populations on one island to another island. But with fungi, we had this one point in the middle of the ocean, and none of the islands around it have been well surveyed. So we just sort of had to go with the sequences that we had. And a pretty obvious step when you have a bunch of sequences is to blast them, to search the GenBank database and try to figure out what's in there. And so we were looking for biogeographic connections. We wanted to see if we found a good match. Where was it from? Now, there are some problems with that sort of approach in that the underlying database is biased. We can't really control. It doesn't have a good sampling, an even sampling worldwide. Another problem is that when you compare a sequence to something that you have to something in GenBank, you don't know exactly what you're going to get. You may get an exact match if you're lucky. And that was not the case with these Morea sequences. There were about 40% of the sequences that had a what we might consider a species level match, 97%, 98% similarity or higher to our sequence. And another 60% of the sequences didn't have a species level match. The further you get apart, the more ways there are to be different. So if you have a 100 base long sequence, and you differ by 1%, there are 100 different ways to be different. If you differ by 5%, thinking of the combinatorial possibilities of where in these 100 bases you could have 5 differences, there are a lot of ways to be 5% different or 10% different. So these database comparisons just didn't work. We had to devise methods using statistical sampling to try to figure out, if we take 500 sequences from GenBank, what does the geographic distribution look like? How does that compare to the sequences that are good species level matches for our 500 sequences? And so it was a lot of fun to try to really figure out what the database was saying and what our sequences were saying.
Yeah, and that's kind of that next step where I've spoken with people about that raw data collection side. And then there's that kind of next step of actually using that data, doing what you're talking about, statistical analyses to see what you can learn. And it sounds like even that process to figure out how to structure an examination of the data to learn something is a process and takes some thinking on its own. But for the actual sequencing, just as a quick overview, and maybe it's not such a quick process to give an overview of, but what does that look like when you're out in the field, you collect a specimen, how do you then bring it down to extraction and sequence? And then maybe we can talk about what data you get back and how you can use that.
Well, the first thing we do is preserve the so that we can get it back and so that we can save a voucher of it as well.
Right.
A vouchered specimen is a lot more valuable than an unvouchered one. Once we get it back to the lab, we crush it up and do some biochemistry to extract the DNA out of the crushed up cellular material. I use a really simple technique generally. I just throw some 0.5 molar sodium hydroxide in, which is an alkaline solution. It has a pH of about 13.5, so it's pretty alkaline stuff.
Yeah.
And that will disrupt the cells enough to spill the DNA out into solution. It's not clean, but it generally works for the next step. And that was one thing I found along the way, is that people were doing generally DNA extractions that were a lot more complicated, a lot more time consuming, use a lot more toxic chemicals, and generate a lot more waste. And so that's something that I'm really cognizant of when I'm doing this lab work. We throw away a lot of plastic as it is, and it's really important to me that we try to minimize the impacts as much as we can.
Yeah, that's something you don't think of when it comes to this kind of research, is the amount of plastic waste. And it sounds like you're getting to the end goal, which makes sense, but I love the way you just explained that. You're just trying to break open the material enough to let that genetic information spill out, and then you amplify what spills out, right?
Right, exactly.
So that's when PCR comes in. You're essentially amplifying those genetics over and over and over again to get a much clearer picture of what they are. And then what do you get back from that process? Because I've seen it and I still don't understand it. So what are you getting back from that process after PCR?
So our genomes, well, all genomes are DNA, which consists of four different chemical components, which we'll just call A, C, G, and T.
Right.
And the order in which those different parts are put together conveys information. And the way I like to tell it to students is, if we took a three nucleotide sequence ACT, that has a different meaning than the three nucleotide sequence CAT. Same thing with DNA language, that in that sequence of letters, there's information. And you can't really see DNA except with an electron microscope. So we have to infer what those chemical constituents are. And so there are some pretty fancy biochemical techniques of figuring out what they are. Some of the newer techniques actually feel the nucleotides. They take the DNA and they thread it through a protein that's embedded in a synthetic membrane, kind of like a synthetic cell membrane. And as the DNA is pulled through this little protein pore, the amount that the pore has to deform in order for that nucleotide to fit through can actually be, the amount of deformation can actually be read as an electrical signal. So this sequencing technology is actually really feeling nucleotides.
That's incredible. I've never heard of that before. Blows my mind. So then the output you get, this series of sequences, then you're having to upload that to GenBank or using some kind of comparison to figure out what that's telling you. And I guess it's only as useful as the data that already exists.
Right. What you do with it after that really depends on what kind of technology you used to sequence. Usually when we're crushing up DNA for instance, the North American Microflora Project, that DNA was being sequenced in a way that will give you a good sequence of one gene. And with that sequence, you get an electronic file that shows the chemical signal of each nucleotide. And you can go through and actually look at that chromatograph and look at each nucleotide and be confident that you agree with what the computer is telling you, because the computer's reading that information and then spitting out a letter. But you can go through and actually edit that. So the first step that we'll do is edit the sequences. With more modern technologies that will give you millions or even hundreds of millions of sequences in one run, you just can't look at every nucleotide. So you have to depend on the quality scores that come out with the data, and you have to kind of trust them. The computers are getting it right.
Can't imagine having to crawl through and correct the computer analysis to give us that letter, I'm not sure I would feel confident overriding the computer in that situation. And then for fungi specifically, because obviously the genetic process you're breaking down, I would imagine it's pretty cross-similar across organisms.
Right. There are a limited number of technologies, and we use them for whatever we're sequencing.
How do fungi, compared to maybe plants and compared to animals, how are fungi differentiated? Or is there not that much difference? I mean, when you're looking at sequences of an animal or of a plant or of a fungi, does it generally look the same? I'd imagine you're working with the same organic molecules and compounds.
Right. The data themselves look the same, but the orders of the nucleotides will be quite different.
I've often heard that when it comes to species with fungi, it's actually not very clear-cut. You know, we like to think that things fit neatly into these categories that you get with macro fungi, where you think, oh, that thing is knowable. I know it's, but it sounds like with DNA data, a lot of gray areas entered into it. I guess, can you demystify that a little bit, or at least why there's such mystery surrounding that? I just know that there's mystery and things are ill-defined, but I'm not sure why.
Well, some of it's operational. So when you get a DNA sequence, there can be multiple closely related species that have that same DNA sequence. For instance, ITS, which is the gene that we generally use for fungal barcoding, doesn't work very well in fusarium molds. It doesn't work very well in aspergillus or penicillium, a lot of the really important mold genera.
Right.
Doesn't work very well in morels, for instance, unless you use it in association with other genes. There are just some species, especially ones that diverged fairly recently or fairly rapidly, where the sequences are just too similar to tell them apart. Another thing is the quality of the databases that you mentioned before, that it's really the data that you have that allow you to take a sequence and get some information out of it. And then part of it is biological. So there are some biologists that just don't even believe in the concept of species at all, that there are just individuals and there are not clear boundaries between species.
Right.
So there's probably some of that going on in fungi as well. We think about soil and all the hyphae that are crawling around in the soil. And there are mechanisms, genetic mechanisms, that prevent different species sometimes from melding together, but they're not perfect.
Yeah, and mycelium have that ability to meld across what we would consider a species barrier. So I think that's a really good explanation for why it is hard to categorize. My mind wants to start categorizing. It's what the human brain wants to do. So it's, you got to get comfortable with the fact that, yeah, we may have to look at these things more on an individual basis. And I think you've just explained that really well. And then what are clades? Because I often hear people talk about the groupings. Now we use a clade organizational system when we look at fungi, where they come from, what they're related to. What are clades, and how do you use to help with this grouping or identification of individuals?
Well, clades are an idea that come from morphological systematics. They're not really new to molecular data. And the idea is that it defines a group. If you build a phylogenetic tree, that it's a group where everything in a particular group shares the same common ancestor. For instance, if you tried to classify reptiles without the birds, for instance, you don't have a clade, you don't have a monophyletic group, because if you don't include the common ancestor and all of its descendants in a tree. So in a tree, you can recognize a clade as a group of species on that tree that are joined, where the branches are all joined to the same point.
Sure. And the genetic information that would get you to that ancestor, so you know which clade it's in, are those present in every gene? Because I know you said that sometimes you're isolating just one gene in an organism to sequence versus hundreds or millions of genes. So I guess we could even get into how do you separate just one gene out for sequencing when there are so many in there? And then is there a specific gene that has that clade lineage information, if you will, within it? Or is that present in every gene and it's just certain combinations of nucleotides let you know, oh, that comes from here?
Ideally, that information would be present in every gene, but
right.
It doesn't happen.
Frustrating.
It is frustrating. There was an interesting study that came out a while ago now, at least 10 years ago now, where they looked at genomic sequences of yeasts and then built a phylogeny based on genome sequences and then looked at individual genes to see how well the individual genes replicated the same tree as the full data set. And it turns out that most of the genes that we use for phylogenetics didn't perform very well.
Oh.
So single genes just isn't going to get you to the right answer most of the time. But in phylogenetics now, it's common to use anywhere from 4 genes to hundreds of genes. There was a brand new paper that just came out that looked at the kingdom level phylogeny of fungi using 190 genes for about 1600 different species. So the data sets are getting really big. And that has a lot to do with the sequencing technologies that are available now that weren't available even 10 years ago.
We hear the stories of what people have discovered, you know, that chanterelle are much older type of dispersal mechanism with veins. And you can see that through these clade groupings and their common ancestors. So it made me wonder how we can be sure of that information when we're examining genes. And then in that process, you know, you described the breaking up of organic material, letting that genetic information out so then you can perform PCR. How are you able to isolate individual genes in kind of a genetic soup like that?
The PCR reaction itself allows us to do that. So one of the components in the PCR reaction is called a primer pair. And the primers are going to bind to the DNA based on the sequence of the primers. So if you design them well, with a little bit of luck, they're going to bind to the right place on the DNA, the place that you're looking for, and only that place. And that's where the amplification, the copying of the DNA starts and ends. So you can really define the exact part of the genome that you want, as long as you know a little bit about what the sequences of the DNA are on the two ends.
Seems like primers, again, for a novice, this idea of primers is hugely important. Where do you find the right primers?
Yeah, just know something about the sequence and send off to a company.
Okay. Yeah.
Like the sequences.
For me, I'm still learning a lot, so I appreciate you breaking down really these fundamental concepts that are helping me visualize, and I'm sure a lot of listeners visualize, what that process of genetic sequencing actually looks like, and demystifying a lot of this. And it's interesting to think that on that trip on Morea, do you think that species that didn't match when you did a blast on GenBank, could that have been due to not having that full picture because it was only one or a certain kind of genes, or is that not really the issue?
I think the bigger issue is what's in the database.
Okay.
So there are between 1 million and 2 million fungal ITS sequences in GenBank. And depending on which species diversity estimates you believe, whatever species estimate you believe, that's probably a small number of sequences, given that a lot of sequences are, that one species may have hundreds of sequences in GenBank. So it's not 1 to 2 million species.
Right.
But the species level estimates of fungi run anywhere from about 700,000 up to 165 million, a recent estimate that came out a couple years ago.
What? 165 million?
Right.
I thought I had 1.5 million in my head as like this astronomical number, 165 million.
A lot of that's because we can now claim the microsporidians as fungi.
Ah, the microsporidians. Now, what are those newly claimed fungi?
Those are single-celled intracellular parasites mostly infecting animals. And this paper that came out a couple of years ago estimated that every animal species, which they estimated there are about 163 million, if each animal species has a microsporidian species, there have to be 163 million species of microsporidians. And then they threw on a couple million soil fungi, and they said, as far as the endophytes go, we have no idea, so we're not even including.
Vast amount to explore. That was my next question, was how complete is our picture of the world of fungal genomics? And with those kind of numbers going around, it seems like we're probably only at the very, very tip of the iceberg.
That's right. The more temperate mycologists might go with the 1.5 million to 5 million species estimates. But
right.
Even there, with about 120,000 species or so described, we have a long way to go. David Hibbett estimated that it would take hundreds of years to describe all of those, all the fungi that we think we have, if we describe every single one.
I always say it's going to be this multi-generational effort, and people like myself are all getting excited and tuning into mycology, and I think we're just at this massive wave that's going to be needed to actually piece together all this information. Now, we talked about your project in Morea. You've done loads of research when it comes to genetics. But are there any other projects that stand out where you had unique findings, maybe just an interesting story when it comes to this work with genetics?
There are a couple of projects I've been working on with graduate students over the last few years that have been really fun, really interesting projects. One was with Andy Bruce, who a lot of your listeners probably know. She's been really involved in the mycological community. She works for Bolt now in the Bay Area. She was working on a micro-remediation project, and the fungi that we were trying to grow in the lab just were not behaving themselves very well. And so she did what a mycologist should do when they run into a wall on something: go out in the woods and walk around a little bit. She came back with this picture of this bright yellow oyster mushroom that she had found in Hickson Forest just outside of La Crosse. And she did a little web research and found that this mushroom was coming up in wild habitats. It's a cultivated mushroom, not native to North America, native to Asia. And she asked me if I thought this would be an interesting thesis project. And I just looked at this mushroom that seems to have escaped from cultivation. Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And so she ran with it. And this is another aspect of what you had mentioned with citizen scientists in mycology. This project would have been impossible without people getting involved in it. And Andy did just a fantastic job of reaching out to people through social media. And she was getting specimens from all over the range. It's been found in the forests from about Minnesota, Iowa, to the East Coast. And so she was getting specimens from New York, from Pennsylvania, from Iowa, from Minnesota, from Wisconsin, from all over the place. And it was really just a fantastic project. And we're looking at, did that mushroom escape once from cultivation and spread? Did it escape multiple times? And so we're trying to piece together the invasion biology using genome data. So she was sequencing whole genomes of these isolates that people were sending in. That was a lot of fun, and we're still working on that one. And another project is looking at fire morels, and that's with a recently graduated master's student, Annie Schauster, who's now at University of Colorado, Denver, working on her PhD. And for a long time, I've been interested in burn morels, just how they come up in such huge numbers after a forest fire, and that whole biology. And there are a number of questions that I had about that. First of all, what is the purpose of this mass fruiting? Is it really increasing genetic diversity through all this potential for sexual reproduction that spore production has? Or is it just kind of setting the reset button? Is it just producing mushrooms, they drop their spores, and regenerate the same individuals ready to go after the next fire?
Right.
And so what we're really asking is, what happens in between? So in between this fire, mass fruiting of mushrooms, and the next fire, what are those things doing? Are they growing a little bit and then forming resting structures and then waiting it out? Soil consistently until the next fire? Are they sort of resprouting from these resistant propagules, or are they consistently growing between these fire events? And so yeah, another project using genomic data to really be able to distinguish individual mycelia using a lot of data.
My ears perked up when I heard burn morels. Those are some of the massive questions that people have surrounding them. So has there been any findings yet or anything that gave you any insights on those questions?
Yeah, it seems like they are growing a little bit. They are reproducing from spores. The spores are really important for reproduction.
So between season, they're actually having to do the full sporulation process and have sexual reproduction and recreate the mycelium, basically.
Right. But it seems like that mycelium doesn't grow very much between fire events. So it probably grows a little, forms a resting structure, and then just waits it out until the next fire. At least that's what we think based on the data. So we're finishing up a few analyses and hoping to get that sent out for publication this fall.
I guess, how did genetic information come into play there to establish that whole process?
Well, I like to think of it sort of similarly to how DNA is used in criminal forensics, for instance.
Sure, yeah.
Where if we gathered an ITS sequence, a DNA barcode sequence, you could probably tell what species it belonged to, but you couldn't really get a lot of individual variation. To really pinpoint an individual, you need to look at the FBI's CODIS database. It looks at 13 different loci throughout the genome. Ancestry.com collects data on about 700,000 nucleotides in the genome, which seems like a lot. Out of 3 billion, it's not that many, but
yeah,
700,000 data points is a lot, and you can really distinguish individuals really well. And that's kind of the scale of data that we were looking for. So we were looking at tens of thousands of positions in the genome that differ between individuals, and you can really get a good idea who an individual is and who they're related to.
And of course, that would be relevant if you're trying to see if it's the same mass of mycelium refruiting or if it's a new mass of mycelium through spores. You would need that individual level of data. That's really fascinating stuff. Another paper I was reading from your work was about herbariums. And I think there are people that know about fungal herbariums, basically stockpiles of dried mushroom samples, some of them, you know, decades old. How can herbariums help us with completing this picture of the fungal genome?
I think they're really critical for any sort of taxonomic study. Certainly, you can't collect everything in a particular group that you might be working on at once and have it from everywhere in the world.
Right, right.
So having these collections worldwide that researchers can look at is really vital. When these collections were made, a lot of them, some of them are hundreds of years old, nobody knew that we were going to be sequencing DNA from them 100 years later. And there have been some really interesting studies that have come out over the past several years that show that you can even get genomic data. You can sequence the whole genome or a good part of the genome out of these herbarium specimens 60, 80, 100 years old.
So they're like vaults or like genetic vaults that we have.
Absolutely.
I would assume that most herbariums, of course, have sequenced what they have in their collection. But is it just the case that, you know, the technology is relatively new and it just there aren't enough people or hours put in yet to really start that project everywhere?
You would think that maybe the herbaria are sequencing all their specimens, but not even close. There are some really great efforts going on right now to digitize collections, to get the collection data online, take pictures of the specimens, take pictures of the notes, and make the collections more accessible to the public. But as far as genetic sequencing goes, it's really hard to get grant funding to sequence an herbarium. You really have to have another question. So there are pieces of herbaria if someone's studying a particular group of fungi they'll probably sequence a lot of herbarium collections. And so they get sequenced that way. But just as efforts to sequence all of the herbarium collections that we have, it's the funding agencies just haven't really been very enthusiastic about that idea, even though it would be really valuable.
Yeah, and I think it would be one of those situations where once you have the data, then you can start pulling the insights. You know, the questions could really spawn out of having the data, but that makes sense what you're talking about. You need to have some purpose to explore it, for people to give you money, that whole system. And, you know, we've talked about a couple of your specific research projects, but it seems like one theme that runs through your projects is looking at geographic distributions and evolutionary patterns when it comes to fungi. How do those two go hand in hand, and how are they really informed by genetic data? And then why are they important? You know, why is it important to know the history of different fungi and how they maybe came to be where they are?
Part of it
small is, question, I know.
Right, exactly. Part of it is a personal fascination, wondering how these things live. And I think that's kind of what's my research program has gone more and more in that direction, from identification and describing biodiversity, which I think is really important.
Right.
But I think this happens to a lot of academic mycologists, that once you have the ability to use bigger and more expensive tools and get at some of these questions about the whys, looking at the biology and the broader evolutionary patterns, it's a really fascinating area of exploration. So I find myself spending a lot more time trying to write computer scripts to crunch data than I spend out in the woods, which makes me a little sad, but that's kind of the way it's gone. But yeah, as far as diversity goes, and as far as biogeographic distributions, I'm really interested and really driven by conservation. And in order to understand what the needs are for conservation, we need to know what fungi exist, where they exist, how rare they are, how common they are, how endemic they are to particular regions. And then once we have that kind of information, we can start to understand which fungi are most threatened and which habitats need the most aggressive conservation action. And a lot of that information we just don't have.
Protecting biodiversity is a big deal. And obviously, it seems like with flora and fauna, because they're all visible and because they're generally more cataloged, we have a much better system of creating protected areas where, let's say, development can't occur, things of that nature. What is the framework currently for fungal conservation? I imagine it varies depending on where you are in the world, but in general, and maybe we focus here in the US, what does that framework look like? Are we doing anything to protect and conserve fungi?
Well, when I first started my PhD program in conservation biology, there were three fungi that were covered under the Endangered Species Act. And that was mostly because they were covered under the CITES treaty, the treaty that governs international trade of endangered species. And they were all lichenized fungi. So there were three fungi. In Europe, conservation action on fungi has been going on longer and more aggressively. So a lot of European countries have fungal red lists, which come from the term rarity, endangerment, and distribution. So they have a better idea, because they have a better idea of fungal diversity in those countries. They're more able to determine what's threatened. But over the past several years, there's been an effort to bring the fungal red listing activity worldwide. So in the US, Greg Mueller has been extremely active in that area. And he's held a number of workshops. I was able to go to one in Oregon in 2015, where there were about 15 of us, I think, who brought ideas about which fungi we think we should look into. And then we spent the next several days just looking at getting into groups and looking at these species that people had proposed, and digging up as much data as we could to try to figure out whether there's evidence that it's rare, whether there's evidence that its habitat is declining, to try to get that data that you really need in order to fulfill the criteria for red listing. And we came up with a lot of data deficient fungi. So when you don't have the information that you need in order to determine what red list category they should go in, you classify them as data deficient. And there were a lot of data deficient fungi in that list. So the framework is building. It's getting to be something that is getting more attention, and certainly fungi are getting, there's a bigger role for fungi in conservation, but there are a lot of information gaps that we have to fill.
Anyone who's looked into kingdom fungi, you see how ubiquitous they are in natural systems, how they're often key players in ecosystems to maintain ecosystem health. Anyone can think of that easy example of mycorrhizal fungi. You wouldn't have plants without them. So yes, we need to protect them. I'm just always surprised that there aren't already really robust conservation efforts just based on that importance. You know, once we find out something like that, you would think immediately alarm bells would be going off and people would be saying, hey, we need to catalog these populations. We want to see the roles that they play and how we can protect them. And, you know, and then there are certain fungi I know that here at UC Berkeley, Tom Bruns is studying how fungi help reestablish environments after fire, which seems more important than ever. So you'd think that situationally, you would look at their value to an ecosystem. Does that play a role when you're looking at red listing? Anything like that? Does their central role in an ecosystem, one of those criteria?
It has a lot more to do with whether it's whether there's evidence that it's they're rare or declining. Its own conservation needs are primary in this.
Yeah.
There's been really great habitat work. The survey and manage program in the Pacific Northwest old growth forests as part of the Northwest Forest Plan in the early 90s is probably the biggest ecosystem level conservation effort for fungi that's ever been done in North America.
Wow.
And what they did in that work was to catalog the fungi that seemed to be restricted to these old growth forest habitats. This was during the listing of the northern spotted owl. And so they were looking within the habitat of that species, what fungi seemed to be restricted to that habitat. And there were some great publications that came out of that work showing fungi that do seem to be restricted to that habitat. So great conservation work there.
And it really takes that kind of huge concerted effort to put the relevant pieces together. And when we talk about soil fungi, you know, maybe not our microscopic parasites, because that would make the universe a little too big, but maybe some of the soil fungi and the endophytes, do those play a role in any of these conversations as well?
They haven't really had a role in conservation planning, red listing, but the diversity of these fungi is huge. There's a lot of undiscovered biodiversity when we look at endophytes. It's a really exciting area of research.
Yeah, because I know you've done some research on endophytic fungi, and maybe because that one's so fascinating, fungi that grow within plants, maybe you could highlight one or two research projects that you did just centering around endophytes. And I mean, just the gene sequencing, I imagine it's a little more clear cut than but how would you separate out the fungal material from the plant material? Just give us an overview of maybe a research project involving endophytes.
There are a couple of ways that you could study endophytes. One is to culture them. That's the hard way. With the advantage that you know that they were endophytes because you've actually grown them out of the leaf tissue.
Right.
But you only get the culturable ones. The other way to do it is to just take the leaf tissue, usually try to surface sterilize it, get the spores that are just sort of free riding on the surface of the leaf off, and then crush up the leaf material, use fungal primers in your PCR reactions to amplify just the fungal genes, and then sequence that. And we did a couple studies in Morea where we looked at three of the dominant canopy tree species. And we're interested in looking at the different historical arrivals of these trees, as this island and a lot of the Polynesian islands have this really interesting biological history where there were native species that came in as seeds, usually from other mainland areas onto these islands. And then there were the early Polynesian introductions. They took a number of plants with them, for instance, plants that they built their canoes out of. And then more recent introductions. And we were comparing them and found that there's really very little overlap in the endophytes between these different tree species. But where there is overlap seems to be more geographical. Being close or being in the same habitat means you're going to have a more similar endophytic community on different islands, for instance, in some cases. So some interesting patterns there.
Yeah, and just something like endophytes where they are within plant material makes that idea of biogeography and how did these things spread, that question definitely stands out. You're probably familiar with, I believe it's either foraging ascomycete or foraging endophyte, according to the name of that hypothesis that basically postulates endophytes may be essentially propagules or a little bit of mycelial material waiting to fall on the forest floor and then begin the process of decomposing or activating some kind of saprobic capacity.
I think there's a lot to that. When we look at wood samples, there are a lot of Xylariaceous fungi in there that you usually see as saprotrophs, as decomposers, once the tree dies. So I think there is a lot of that, that fungi are just sort of waiting it out until the host dies and then they'll eat it.
The human brain wants to categorize, and fungi seem to often defy category with their species and their capabilities. Endless amount of shifting and adapting that they can do, it seems like, with many millions of years of evolution behind them developing those capabilities.
Seems that we forgot to tell the fungi about the categories.
Yeah, they didn't get the memo that they're supposed to be easily categorized. You know, you've been to so many different places in the world observing fungi, doing this work out in the field. What's that been like for you? I mean, what's that been like to visit different cultures, get different insights about fungi? How has that changed your professional career, maybe some of your perspectives?
It's the best part of the job. The is the best part of the job. Fieldwork is hard. It's not vacation by any means, but it's
right.
Really worthwhile. It certainly changes your cultural perspectives, just being the guest in another country, in another culture, especially one where you don't know the language. My Chinese is pretty lousy. My Thai is non-existent. Spanish, barely passable. So being in another country, in another culture, you really build an affinity for people, which is an experience that, frankly, it would be nice if a lot more people had. And mycologically, too, it really makes you stretch your perspectives scientifically as well. For instance, there's a species of bolete that occurs at one, we found it, I believe, at one, just one field site in Australia, in eastern Australia, that looks like Boletus separans, which is a bolete species that has sort of a nice purple rosy stipe. But if you drop a drop of ammonia on it, it just turns this bright turquoise blue. Beautiful mushroom and a beautiful staining reaction. So the mushroom looks just like that, unless you look at the pores, where in Boletus separans it would have sort of a lightly colored pore surface. And this bolete in Australia has a pink pore surface. So it's sort of a Mr. Potato Head mushroom. If you took Boletus separans and put a Tylopolis pore surface on it, you have this mushroom. So we're calling it Tylopolis separans because it's sort of like a Tylopolis and it's sort of like Boletus separans. But we need to figure out which one it is. Where does it actually go? And so you really have to stretch your perspectives. Looking at some of the work that Terry Henkel and his colleagues have done in Guyana, Russulas that look like pleurotus and grow on wood, for instance. You have an idea of what you think this group of mushrooms is, and then you see something that just causes you to realize that it's not as simple as you thought it was.
Right, stretching perspectives culturally from the anthropomorphic side, and definitely mycologically when you're getting all kinds of novel fungi being thrown at you and you're doing your best trying to keep up. Well, that's really fascinating stuff. And then I have to ask, because you are at University of Wisconsin La Crosse, what has it been like to work with Tom Volk, and how has he influenced your career? I noticed you've authored papers together. What's that been like? Because he's such a well-known kind of rock star in mycology.
That was another happy accident that happened to me. I had noticed when I was looking for jobs that University of Wisconsin La Crosse had posted this job for a geneticist. And even though I used genetic data all the time, I didn't really think of myself as a geneticist. You know, I don't cross fruit flies. Well, I do now teaching students, but I didn't at the time set up genetic crosses or build chromosome maps or anything like that. So I didn't really consider myself a geneticist. And I ran into Tom at a NAMA foray in California in 2012, I guess, and said, "Oh, I saw you had a genetics job." He said, "You should apply." And I wasn't going to, but I did. And it worked out really well. So about three doors down from Tom, we co-advise graduate students together, which works really well because Tom attracts people with his star power. He'll be giving talks somewhere. Somebody will come up and ask him if he's taking grad students, and he tells them, "Well, I'm going to retire in a couple of years, but you should email Todd Osmundson." And so he's been my most important recruiting. And we have a mycological reading group here. We developed a graduate level class where we read mycological literature and talk about it. We even try to bring in authors of some of the papers by Skype to talk to the students. We'd like to make that a class that's more available, bring it online and involve people that aren't necessarily UWL students. Something that we're hoping to get going here.
The La Crosse Mycological Podcast. I think that's what you guys need to do.
I've discussed it with him.
Good. That would be fantastic.
Maybe we'll do it. But we're one of the few undergraduate programs in the country that has a concentration in plant and fungal biology. So you can take medical mycology here. You can take mycology. You can take plant-fungal interactions. You can take this 21st century mycology class. Probably more mycology than even a lot of big institutions have. So it's been really great.
Yeah, that's really stands out about Wisconsin La Crosse is how robust a mycological program there is there. And I see it growing at other universities. Obviously, you just mentioned Terry Hinkle. So I know Humboldt has a program. I think quite famously Evergreen College does. What is that landscape like a little bit? You see mycology really on the rise in academia. Are you getting more, you know, maybe starstruck grad students coming from Tom Volk's lectures? But are you seeing this on the rise? Because obviously on the citizen science side, there's kind of this explosion, which again, I'm symptomatic of. But do you see that in academia as well?
I do. There are a lot of positions open in fungal biology. I would say that in taxonomy, whether it's fungi or any organism, really, the number of positions that are opening up in taxonomy is dwindling. In genomics, in ecology, a lot of mycologists that are getting academic jobs now are working in ecology or working in genomics, working in phylogenetics. So not necessarily taxonomy. And that's where the citizen science community really comes in, is they're critical to this aspect. There aren't enough academic mycologists to describe fungal biodiversity in the planet. And frankly, there never have been. This idea that there are these specialist mycologists, these professional mycologists who are doing all the work, just there were maybe a few decades where that was largely true, but it wasn't true before that, and it wasn't true. It's not true now.
Right. With all those focus on ecology and the genomics, what are some applications of that genomic data. And what I mean is, are there ways that we can isolate genes from fungi and apply them elsewhere? Is that one of the big goals? Because I'd imagine if there are more positions, that means there's just more funding surrounding it. There's more potential commercial or other applications. What is some of that potential? Because we've talked about, you know, some of the stuff I'm really interested in and you're interested in, biogeography, evolutionary history. What are some of the applied futures of fungal genomics?
Well, fungi are essential for industrial processes, for medicines. So there are about 80-85% of all medicines that are regularly prescribed that have a natural source, mostly plants, but the fungi come in second. And understanding and where synthetic chemicals are used in medicine, they're generally modeled by playing around with something that comes from a natural source.
Right.
So this idea of fungi as an untapped storehouse, if we've described 100,000 species and there are 165 million or even 1.5 million, yeah, the potential for new compounds that we've not discovered yet is massive. But fungi are also important for industrial processes as well, breaking down wood, breaking down pulp, bioremediation, and understanding how fungi do that could help in understanding those processes better as well.
So there's a lot of amazing chemicals and compounds locked up within these fungi. And that's why it's so valuable to have people who are genetic experts to isolate what those compounds are and how we can use them or model synthetic molecules off it. Kind of mind-boggling stuff, even if you are talking about 1.5 million species of fungi or 156 million. Winding down a little bit, is there any current research or current classes that you want to share with people that stands out, maybe one or two? And then let us know where everyone can find you in your work.
Sure. Some of the really exciting work that's going on in mycology today. I'm definitely interested in the phylogenetic work, all the new insights that are coming out in that work. But just between having new genome sequencing technologies, between having the tools to communicate between people, between having databases, between having groups like the North American Microflora Project, now the Fungal Diversity Survey, we just changed the name, and this network of people who are out there collecting, and a lot of them just great identifiers, being able to work with these, it's really the fungal equivalent of big data, having all these collections and all these genetic resources. And so I think what's going to come out of that in terms of trying to close this gap between how many species we know and how many species we think there might be is really exciting. One of the things that happened when I was at UC Berkeley was that I either got an email or I ran into them at a Mycological Society of San Francisco event or something. I got this inquiry from Alan Rockefeller, who wanted to learn how to sequence fungi. And so he worked on some of these Moraya sequences. He sequenced those Moraya mushrooms and then went out and took what he had learned, bought a bunch of used equipment for a hackerspace that he was part of in San Francisco, and then just took it on the road and has been showing clubs all over the country how people can do this with a minimum of equipment. I think it's really great. So even some of the things that have typically been the purview of the academics is now in the hands of citizen scientists. And I think it's a really exciting time when people are really interested in collections, are really interested in getting genetic data.
And his work in that space in Oakland in Omni Commons was what really opened up my mind, because I was part of that group when I first got into mushrooms called Bay Area Applied Mycology, and seeing him do actual sequencing work, which you know, I didn't understand at the time, and I'm still not sure I do even after talking to Todd Osmundson. But even seeing that work really opened up my mind to the potentials, what was really involved here beyond the forest. You know, there's this next level of analyzing and getting data and like what the full timeline of the scientific process, if you will, is when it comes to fungi. So yeah, I think you are directly responsible for activating so many citizen scientists and pushing people deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole of mycology just from training Alan. What a cool story to bring things full circle.
Thought of taking it on the road the way he has. Really remarkable.
Of course, he teaches people who then develop their own extraction amplification methods. So you've kind of started that domino effect. You've infected one and now he's infecting others. Really, really cool. And yeah, where can people find you and your work? Where is the best place? Is it TikTok or is it a website? Where's the best place to find you?
Check out the UWL biology webpage and find my profile there. And then any links that you need will be there.
Yes, it's very well laid out. And I can tell you, you can go down the whole Todd Osmundson rabbit hole just by going to the University of Wisconsin La Crosse webpage. And I will have you leave us with a couple questions that I ask all my guests. I'm really interested to hear your answers. But what is a mushroom that you love and why? And this doesn't have to be a favorite because you can't possibly choose from 156 million different species. But what is a mushroom you love and why that you want to share with us?
One of them I've already mentioned, this weird Mr. Potato Head, Tylophilus. Just because it completely blew my mind. And the other one would be this species of Licaria that I found near Khao Yai National Park in Thailand. And the thing that was really cool about that is that when I saw the thing, I knew that it was a species I had never seen, I had never heard of, just saw it and I figured this was probably new to science. We're still working on the taxonomy of that and determining whether it really is, but just getting to know a group of fungi well enough that you can go out in the field and see something new. It's the feeling comfortable with the knowledge, but also just finding that new thing that kind of blows your mind as well.
Well, I'm sure for someone like you, the absolute new might be a little few and far between. So that is really, really cool. And then what has a relationship with fungi and mushrooms given to you? Obviously, your beginnings were, you know, not in the mycological world at all. So what has that relationship that you've developed with fungi given to you and brought to your life?
It's been fascinating, the abilities to travel to different parts of the world and collect, getting to know these organisms that are so interesting and so important, and really the people that you meet, just hanging out with other people that are interested in fungi, whether it's at a foray or professional conference. Mycology is just filled with fantastic, interesting people, and that's really been the best part.
Beautiful answer. I think so many people fall in love with mushrooms and the mycology community just as much, if not more so. And then what is the lasting impact that you hope to make with your work? You've got quite an extensive body of work. We've talked about some of the direct impacts you've probably had, but what is the lasting legacy you hope to leave, or the lasting impact you hope to make in this greater field of studying mushrooms and mycology?
Your work eventually will fade, I think. You know, there are certainly giants in the field who we still read today. Always amazed at how phylogenetics keeps giving us new insights that Rolf Singer had 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But for most of us, I think our work will probably fade, but the impacts that we have on other people, that's our ability to keep the field going and keep interest in the field and spread the network, I think is the biggest impact that most of us can have.
And even if it's lost in the sands of time, it clearly is a huge, huge part of moving forward and starting this, I mean, what's going to be the next massive exploration in science, which is discovering all the secrets that fungi have. So you can't really understate the importance of the work that you and so many mycologists are doing in helping people like me get inspired and learn more and get involved. Well, Todd, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It was really a privilege to get to speak with you and ask you questions that I'm sure you're very familiar with that really flesh out an understanding, I think, for any amateur mycophile and make this delineation between the professional and amateur blur a little bit, get us inspired that we can keep moving down the path of mycology. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your show. It's fantastic.